Okay, today we're talking about conformation and steric energy. So, dealing with this properly requires that you understand the arrangement of things in space. And if you understand it, you can draw it. You can draw pictures as good as those that Ernst Mohr drew in 1918 on the basis of the Bragg's X-ray determination of the crystal structure of diamond. So, but you have to know what you're looking at in order to draw it properly. People say, oh, I'm not an artist, I can't draw this. It's not because, if you can't do it, it's not because you're not an artist, it's because you don't know what you're looking at. First, notice that that CC bonds on opposite sides of the ring are parallel to one another in cyclohexane. So the two red ones, the two blue ones, the two green ones. Okay? So when you draw the ring in this chair form, make it with opposite sides parallel. Okay? Then, once you have the carbons in place, you have to get the hydrogens in the right place. Now, there are two classes of hydrogens. Remember, that's what troubled Bayer, because he thought that there would be two isomers if you put a substituent group on it, if it had this form, if it weren't planar, if the carbons were not in a common plane. So there are bonds called axial, right? They're called axial because they're parallel to the threefold symmetry axis of the thing. If you rotate 120 degrees, you get the same thing you started with. So the axial bonds are parallel to that. The ones on the carbons that are high go up. The ones that are on carbons that are low go down. Okay? And then you have to put on the equatorial carbons, as they're called. And they are anti-parallel, anti, to the next adjacent carbon-carbon bond. For example, the one on the left there is parallel, or more properly, anti-parallel, to the carbon-carbon bonds, not from its carbon, but from the next carbon. Okay? Now, let's see if you've got that. At that carbon, what o'clock should we draw the bond to the hydrogen? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. What o'clock? 2? 7? 8? Eight. Eight. Oh, we'll have an auction. How many say 1? You have to vote. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. The majority have it. It's 8 o'clock, right? Because it's anti-parallel to the next adjacent CC bond. Now, you see that Z there? Right? There's the CH bond, then there's a carbon-carbon bond, then the next carbon-carbon bond. And the CH bond is anti-parallel to the next adjacent. It's especially good to say anti-parallel because they're in the anti-conformation, 180 degrees, right across that central bond of the Z. Okay, let's try again. How about there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2. Good. it's between 1 and 2. Okay, how about here? 1, 2, 3, 4. Good. Okay. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2. Good, takes you a minute, okay? And how about at the last one? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Good. Okay, they're anti-parallel to the next adjacent CC bond. So all you have to do is be able to draw lines that are parallel to one another, right? You don't have to be an artist to do that, to draw a good cyclohexane ring. Now, people seem to want to have a textbook for next semester, and what I'm probably going to adopt is this one, Organic Chemistry by Maitland Jones, who's an alumnus of this, of Yale College and of this department too. But it's interesting what he chose to put as the artwork on the front of the book. It's how to draw a good cyclohexane. Okay? And on the back, he's got this thing that says visualize, understand, draw. That is, understanding is closely related to being able to visualize it and to being able to draw it. And just to show you how general this idea, how important the idea of being able to draw a good cyclohexane, in order to be able to understand the arrangement of things in space, he shows two very popular biological molecules that include such rings. Glucose, which is a carbohydrate. Notice that one of the positions in the ring is taken by an oxygen in this case, right? And on the other side, folic acid, a steroid that's made in the liver. It's a bile acid. Okay, and it notice that the folic acid includes three chair cyclohexane rings, but one of them is a little confusing because it's drawn at a different angle from others. Okay. Now, steroids were one of the early, well, sugars were really the first important, or urea was the first biological molecules, you know, to be made artificially, but that's not much of a biological molecule. The first substantial ones were sugars, so the kind over there, and we'll talk about that next semester in the work of Emil Fischer on doing sugars. And then steroids became very important as synthetic goals because of their importance as hormones in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. So at the same time that stereochemistry was developing as a concept and conformation in organic chemistry, it was in the context of people making steroids. So, for example, here are two pictures from the first paper that really talked about these things. These are intermediates in hormone synthesis, steroid hormone synthesis. And these are sort of complicated pictures to draw, and they don't attempt to show how the atoms are actually arranged the way you do when you draw a chair cyclohexane. But you'll notice that at the bottom left, this alcohol, which is what makes things called sterols, that there's a beta and an alpha. So that's the notation that was introduced in those times when people were working on this to talk about whether the configuration is corresponds to the group coming toward you or going away from you when the molecule is drawn like this. Six ring, six ring, six ring, five ring. Okay. Of course, if you drew the molecule upside down in some different orientation, then what was coming out would be going back. But this is the standard way people decided to draw it. So beta was coming up, alpha was going down. This is sort of old-fashioned notation. If Kahn, Ingold, Prelog had existed at that time, people could have named these things R and S to be unambiguous about which one. But anyhow, beta and alpha was the language that they used and still use. So Bayer observed there was only one cyclohexyl carboxylic acid. But in these compounds where we have cyclohexyl alcohols here on the left, notice that beta and alpha OH groups have different reactivity. Right? Bayer was wrong because the ring can flip and what was axial can become equatorial, interconvert the two, as we see here. Right? The aluminum ones can become sticking out, the ones that are anti-parallel, right? Okay, so it wouldn't work in a regular cyclohexane, but in this cyclohexane, they behave differently, the beta and the alpha. In fact, as you see, they're configurationally diastereotopic because there are other centers, chiral centers in the molecule. Right? So if you change just this one, you go from one diastereomer to another. In a sense of configuration, not just conformation. Now, it was noticing things like this that won D.H.R. Barton a Nobel Prize for inventing what was called conformational analysis. And it was done right at this time in 1950, at the same time that all these things were happening in stereochemistry. So the steroids have rings that are conventionally called A, B, C, and D. You can't imagine how much work was done in synthesizing all sorts of different compounds. They changed society altogether, the synthetic hormones. We'll talk about that a little next semester. But anyhow, Barton decided to redraw ring A to show better how things were actually related in space in terms of conformation, not just configuration, which of course is shown by drawing dotted lines in these to denote alpha versus beta. So he redrew ring A, and here's his picture from the paper of ring A. Now ring B is cut off here. It goes on to the right, but I'm showing just ring A. And you'll notice that he labels the substituents on ring A as either E or P. E meant equatorial. If the thing is viewed as a sphere with north and south pole, these point out more or less toward the equator. Although, in fact, they point up and down, as we saw in our previous drawing exercise. And the P he called polar because it points to the north and south pole. Right? But now we call them axial. So axial and equatorial are the names we use for these positions of substituents on a cyclohexane ring. Now, there's a mistake in his drawing. Can you see what it is? It's not drawn accurately. In fact, there's a whole family of mistakes. So how about the equatorial ones? Are they anti-parallel to the next adjacent CC bond? Let's take this one here, for example. Is it anti-parallel to the next adjacent CC bond? It points from this carbon, it points at 9 o'clock, right? What direction does the next adjacent CC bond point? What direction? 3 o'clock, right? Here's the CC bond. The next adjacent one points to 3. The next adjacent points to 3. So that one's okay. Let's try this one here. That one's pointing pretty near to noon. Is it correct? Right? Because this one points pretty near to 6 o'clock, 6:30 maybe. This is half past noon. Okay? And if you go around all the equatorial bonds, they're all correct. How about what he called the polar bonds or the axial bonds? Are they correct? What direction do polar bonds point, or axial bonds? Yeah. Parallel to the threefold symmetry axis. What direction, what o'clock does the threefold symmetry axis point? Kevin? Right. There's an error here. The threefold symmetry axis that takes one point of the triangle to the next points at about 10 o'clock. Does everyone see that? Right. If you rotate about that axis that's pointing from 5 o'clock to 10 o'clock, right, then each of those triangles goes from one point to the next. If you rotate by 120 degrees around that axis, okay, that's the threefold symmetry axis. So the axial bonds should be parallel to that. Okay, are they? No, they're pointing at noon, right? Or at 6 o'clock. So actually, they should look like this. Okay? So the very first paper that talked about this idea and drew accurate pictures for this purpose and coined the names that we still use was wrong in the way it was drawn. Right? So he got the Nobel Prize in 1969 for development of the concept of conformation and its application in chemistry. So it was the application he got the Nobel Prize for, not for drawing the axial bonds in the wrong direction. Right? But this was quickly corrected, as you will correct it when you learn how to do the drawings properly. Okay, so remember that 1950 was a very active time. Biffert had just determined the absolute configuration of carbon, so Newman was figuring out the Newman projection. Kahn, Ingold, and Prelog were working on how to name things R and S. And the other thing that was happening was molecular mechanics was being developed. And so we're going to talk about that. Now, the ring, remember, can flip. Okay. Now let's think a little bit about how the ring flips. Okay, we showed this last time, that first we flip up the red one, then we flip down the blue one, and we go from one chair to its flipped chair. Now notice that in that process, equatorial bonds become axial bonds. Look at the top left there. You see there's an equatorial bond. And when in the next picture, it's pointing up like that in the boat. And then when we flip it down to make another chair, it's that bond there. So the equatorial became an axial. What do you think happens to the axials? They become equatorial, okay? So let's look at that. There's axial, right? We flip, follow the same two in the next one, in the boat, and then in the inverted chair, and now they're equatorial. So they were originally anti to one another, and they've become gauche to one another. Does everyone see that? They were 180 degrees apart in their torsional angle. Now they're 60 degrees apart in their torsional angle. Okay, now that's really important for the idea of ring flipping. Because if you have more than one six-membered ring, like the compound called decalin, it's called decalin for 10 because it's naphthalene, two benzene rings fused together, but with 10 hydrogens added, a hydrogen added to every carbon. So it's decalin. Okay, so there's decalin. And notice what would happen if you tried to flip it. If you tried to flip it, these two gauche bonds that connect to the rest of the ring would have to become anti. Okay? But that can't be possible because you can't put this one way up here and this one way down here and have these two reach across between them. It would stretch that bond impossibly. Okay? Or they would run into the other carbons that are already there. So you just can't do it. Okay? So you can have gauche but not anti for the two bonds that go to the second ring in decalin. So if you have these two rings fused to one another that way, then you can't flip it, right? Okay, if you're skeptical, you can try with models. Now, incidentally, I was going to pass models around so you can feel this change in rings. They get broken from time to time from people being too vigorous in their flipping. So I've used ones that are already broken here. Here, let's pass them around. And some of them are nitrogens. Yeah. Okay, good. You guys have already seen them here. Here, okay. Whoops. Here's some for you guys here. Pass them around. And I'll put this one here. Okay. Now look what happens to flip it out so you can be doing this. Okay, so you get it into a chair. I've got the one that has all the hydrogens on it. Okay, so you flip one up and then the opposite one down by rotating around bonds. Can those of you who have it do that with me? Get it first into a chair. Can you get it into a chair? No, that's a boat. Hold up your chair. Okay, no, grab the bowsprit, grab it. Hold the stern and hold the bottom left and the bottom right as you're looking at it. And move your left hand up. Okay, now twist your left hand so as to raise that one without changing the direction of the other two. Okay, look, watch what I'm doing. There's a boat. There's a chair. So here's the boat. I'm holding the bow and the stern. Everybody see? And what I'm going to do is twist my right wrist. It'll stretch it a little bit, and then it clicks. And now it's that way. Yeah, you got it. Okay. Do those people who have the model, are you able to do that to get it into a chair? Yeah, it'll do. It easily goes from boat to boat. Watch if I have a boat. Real easy. That's the easiest thing to happen. What you have to do is rotate without letting these change their direction. See that? Grab the bow in the stern and twist the bow down without allowing the adjacent ones to move. See, it's easy to make to do it if the adjacent ones move. But if you do that, it'll click into a chair. Okay, I'll let you fiddle around with that some more while we talk a little bit about using a computer instead of using mechanical models to do this with. So there's a website at the Radboud University in Nijmegen in the Netherlands where they can do these animations. It's fun to go there, but the reason I've chose this particular website is the way in which it's wrong. Okay, to tell you that even things you pay a lot of money for aren't necessarily right in this game. That's maybe the theme of this lecture. Okay, so if you go to that web page, this is what you see. This is a screenshot, and you have a ball here that shows the energy as a function of how many pictures they've made. And if you animate it and play it, the ball will move along to low energy, high energy, low energy, high energy, and at the same time, one of these methyl groups will rotate. It's not a very exciting one, but this is what we've already seen. But so those keys allow you to go single steps. You can click an individual point and see what the molecule looks like at that point and so on. And there's staggered and there's eclipsed. Now, we know what the barrier is. What's the barrier? Don't look at the screen. What's the barrier for rotating ethane? How many kilocalories per mole? Three. Now, they're good, compliant people, so they use kilojoules per mole instead of kilocalories per mole. Okay, American organic chemists all use kilocalories per mole. Okay, but the conversion factor is 0.239. So if this is 5.2, that says 1.24 kilocalories per mole. It's less than half the correct barrier. The computer they used to calculate this was just giving garbage. I mean, the shape is right. It's a sine wave, right? But the numbers are just way off base. I don't know how this possibly happened. But beware when you see things like this. Remember what the real values are. Okay, so forget that. It should be about 2.9 kilocalories per minute, so let the buyer beware. Okay, propane, you can do the same thing, and you find it's sort of fun to watch it because as one of the methyls rotates, the other things move just a little bit. So, but again, remember it's about the same barrier, staggered and eclipsed is now just a little bit higher, but not much higher. Okay, or butane. Now you can do that one, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. There's the gauche arrangement of butane. Let me just do that here. I don't know whether it's better for me to hold this up or to do it here. Can we do it here? Okay, so there's... What conformation is that? Here's your Newman projection. That's eclipsed, right? Fully eclipsed, right? And then if we rotate it, what's that? That's staggered. What's that? That's also staggered, but we need different names for the two. You remember? That's anti, and that one's gauche. Okay, so in this diagram that's up here behind me, right, here's anti, and then we go over a barrier that's not much higher than the barrier. It's about just a little over 3 kilocalories per mole. And then we go to gauche, which of course we would say is higher in energy, right, than the anti. It's often said to be 0.9 kilocalories higher in energy. Why should it be higher in energy here than here? Pardon me? What's close to the methyl group? Yeah, the two methyl groups are getting close to one another. So they're repelling one another, right? That's an interesting concept and something that's sort of new from our history of what's in the models. And then here, they're right on top of one another, so that's way up high. Okay, and again, you can go there and click and watch and not believe anything about the energy values. Forget those. Okay, so the difference between gauche and anti is about 0.9 kilocalories per mole, so we can get the equilibrium constant between them, right? It's 10 to the minus 3/4 times 0.9 or 10 to the minus 0.68 or about 1 to 5. So about one part in five is in the higher energy anti form, right? Or in the higher energy gauche form. It depends on what you mean by gauche form. Because that gauche is, we have this gauche, but we also have that gauche. One is twisted to the right, one's twisted to the left. Right, so they're enantiomers of one another. So if you want the equilibrium constant between gauche and anti, you have to be careful what you mean. Do you mean both gauches, or do you mean just one gauche? Right, so obviously there's going to be a factor of two if you include gauche minus, and it's going to be 1 to 2.3 instead of 1 to 4.7. Okay, the eclipse barrier is about 3.5 kilocalories. Remember, it was 2.9 or 3 for ethane, 3.3 for propane. Now it's just slightly higher in butane, not very much, right? But then that barrier tells you how fast you will go from anti to gauche, right? 10 to the 10.5 per second, right? So pretty darn fast. And then there's the fully eclipsed, which is about 5.5 kilocalories per mole, but is experimentally irrelevant. The others you can measure by rates of things happening or equilibrium constants that you can measure experimentally with spectroscopy. Why can't you measure that highest rate by the rate at which things go over it? Yeah. But that's true of this one too. It doesn't stay there, right? But you can get how high it is by how fast things happen, right? You can measure barriers by measuring rates and using this 10 to the 3/4 or something a little more sophisticated than that. Kevin? Ah, because you can get, remember this is 360 degrees, so this is the same as that. You can get from any place to any other place much easier by going this way, right, rather than having to go over here and come back there. You never have to go that way, so you can't measure the rate. Things don't happen that way. So the only way to get that is by some kind of calculation. Okay? Here's the conformational energy of ethane with its 3 kilocalorie barrier. And as we were saying, if you make it butane, so you have methyls instead of those red hydrogens, and we know that barrier first because of the quantum measuring the spacing of the quantum levels from heat capacity. But if you do it with butane, you get the blue curve. So it's just a little bit higher on those barriers. It's about 0.9, although the paper I took some of these numbers from said it was 0.6 up there. Okay, that was from a calculation. I think 0.9 is probably a better value. And the other barrier they got from their calculation is being 5.5. It's interesting that this paper is a paper from a year or two ago that was published in Iran. But anyhow, you have now much smaller spacing of the quantum levels. Can you see why the spacing should be, the energy should be closer together in butane than in hydrogen case than in ethane? The curves look almost the same. The potential energy is almost the same. Why are the spacing so much smaller? Yeah, there's much more mass that you're trying to move. And remember, when you have higher mass, the wave functions come in and move down in energy, right? So they're much, there's much less quantum effect on butane than there is in ethane. Okay, now the ring flip of cyclohexane here. And again, you can, if you go to that website, you can animate it and watch the thing flip. And I tried doing that here. Let's see if it works. Okay. Yes. Go to the other. This probably isn't even worth it, but if we go here. So here's, see if it loaded properly and we'll play. Yeah. Okay, there it is doing its ring flip, going from one chair to the other chair by way of a boat. And now it goes back again. There's a boat, and then it comes back to the other chair. Okay, again, the energy values aren't worth anything. in this particular animation. And in fact, I don't think it's as easy to understand, because what they do is hold one of these things rigid and then move the other one like this. So they move everything else. Where I think it's much easier to understand if you move, keep those four constant in the middle and move one up and then the, one down and then the other up. Okay? So have you felt this? Has the thing gone down? Have you been able to do this? And you can feel that the chair is rigid. It's hard to get out of a chair. Right? But the boat, once you get that, then it just is... I always think of... Woody Allen's movie with the orb, where they feel the orb. I just like to feel this thing, the way it goes like that. It's so smooth the way it runs. Can you feel that? To go from one chair to the next. Let's go back to here. Where are we? Here. To the next slide. I hope it comes. It won't go there. I shouldn't have done this. I have to go through everything now. But do try doing this. Running these things timed is a pain in the neck. Actually, what I'm going to do is not time it. I'll time it later. Now it's... Maybe it's as fast to get there. So we can review everything we've done so far here. I hope you're running your cyclohexanes as we speak, or as we don't speak. Okay, so here's where I want to stop. Okay, so here's the twisting of the boat. And notice the barrier is only 1 kilocalorie per mole for doing that, whereas it was much higher, remember, much higher for going from a boat to a chair, from a chair to a boat. Okay, now we're going to talk about the other way of getting these energies. Ostensibly, these numbers came from a quantum mechanical program, but it gave garbage as far as the numbers went, although the shapes looked about right. But the other way of doing it is to use what's called molecular mechanics. Now, remember, Bayer came up with the idea of strain. What experiment was that based on? How did he know that small rings were strained? What was the experimental evidence, Henry? Pardon me? Explosive or highly reactive, right? But this is something else. This is measuring the heat content, how much energy, how much you'd get out if you burned it as fuel, for example. Try to measure energy as a function of strain. When you strain the molecule, it has higher energy. And you calculate that change in energy as a function of changing the arrangement of the atoms with the bonds already in place. We're not counting the bonds, but twisting the bonds, bending the bonds, that's called steric energy, right? Or conformational energy. And you reckon it with what's called molecular mechanics, which is essentially Hooke's law applied to strain energy. So here's the first paper, the important paper about molecular mechanics, which is from 1946 and was written by Frank Westheimer, who is your great uncle. He also studied with Conant. So it's the theory of the racemization of optically active derivatives of diphenyl. So here are two benzene rings hooked together, and if you could easily rotate about a single bond, this stuff would not be optically active. It doesn't have any carbons with four different things attached to them. But here's a model of the center of that thing that's shown there that has two bromines on it. And what do you notice? Is the rotation around the central carbon-carbon bond free? Can I rotate like this? No, because the two bromines run together. Well, maybe I can get there the other way. Maybe I can rotate it this way. No, then the bromines run into the hydrogens. Right? So this thing can't rotate. Right? So it can be this way, Or it could be the one that was rotated 180 degrees, which would be twisted the opposite direction. So one's twisted to the left, one's twisted to the right. They're mirror images of one another. So here's a case where you can have conformational isomers that you can actually put in a bottle in resolved form because they can't rotate past one another. Okay? I'll pass this around so that you can feel the and observe the size of relative sizes of hydrogen and bromine. Yeah. Okay, let's see. This was actually studied in the 1930s, at the same time they were studying the chirality of alene, which was another thing that was twisted, remember, one way or the other, the two double bonds in a row. So, in fact, it can racemize, but it's hard to racemize. So it was observed that the barrier to racemization was about 20 kilocalories per mole. How did they measure that? How do you think they measured how high the barrier was for racemization? Mike? Can't hear. Not the equilibrium constant, no. That has to do with how high one is relative to the other, the equilibrium between them. But they're mirror images. The equilibrium constant is one. What could you measure that tells you how high the barrier is, that it's 20 kilocalories per mole? What does that determine? Caitlin? Yeah, Don? The rate, how fast it goes, depends on how high the hill is, right? So what they had observed was that the half-life is 9 minutes at 0 degrees. Why did they do it at 0 degrees? Because if they'd done it at room temperature, it would have been less, a minute or less, right? Because remember, our 3/4 works at room temperature. So at the room temperature, it would be 1/100th of it, a percent would go every second, right? They couldn't measure things that fast in those days. So you could indeed put a single enantiomer in a bottle and keep it, but it has to be a cold bottle. Okay, so this goes at room temperature, it goes pretty fast, about a minute, right? So that had been measured experimentally. Now notice that this molecule, what they were interested in was the bromine moving past the hydrogen, right? Why did they put carboxylic acids on the compound? That seems to be complicating what they had to make. So that's a question for you. How did having carboxylic acid groups on these benzene rings facilitate actually doing the experiment? So you have to think about how you would do, you know, what you'd start with, you make the compound, blah, blah, how you do the experiment, right? How do you know that it's racemized, for example? So do some thinking about that and see if you can figure out why they put carboxylic acid groups on. Okay, but at any rate, the paper really, this paper was a theoretical paper. It was about the experimental observation that there's this 20 kilocalorie barrier. Why? What is it that makes the barrier 20 kilocalories? Could you calculate that? In principle, you could do it by quantum mechanics, right? But in fact, that was out of the question 60 years ago to do that, right? So what they did instead was what's called molecular mechanics. So notice that they say that they have this equation, and it's a sum of a bunch of things that are constant times Q squared, where Q is the amount of some particular deformation. Where do you see that energy is proportional to the deformation squared? That's Hooke's law. So what they're doing is treating molecules like springs, a whole bunch of springs, right? And then they see how much you'd have to distort something to get the bromine past the hydrogen. And what they observe is that they calculate a barrier of 17.3 kilocalories per mole. So that's pretty good in the days when you had to use pencil and paper, right? There were no computers in those days. So this is an interesting paper from that point of view from 1946. And what they found was that at the barrier, when this is assumed to be planar, which made it a much simpler calculation, that this angle for the bromine had opened up by 12 degrees in order to get past the hydrogen. Okay, so that's an early application of molecular mechanics, but obviously once computers became available, this became a much easier thing to do. So molecular mechanics programs calculate the strain, this change in energy from starting with unstrained bonds. The bonds are already there, but you have to change angles, stretch things, squeeze things, and so on. So the molecular mechanics calculate that strain energy, assuming that molecules can be treated as mechanical entities, or I say electromechanical entities, because sometimes there are charges there, and you have to take into account the charges repelling or attracting one another. Okay, to achieve useful precision, they require a very large set of empirical force constants. These things don't come from fundamental theory, right? And I'm going to illustrate that here. So these constants are adjusted arbitrarily to make energies match experiment or reliable quantum calculations, right? So you try to figure out how strong should these springs be in order to get energies that will match experiment. Okay, and once you have, and you're assuming that it's going to work, that they do really behave like springs, which of course, in truth, they can't. When they're certainly not when they're deformed very much. So here's from a particular thing called MM2, one particular such scheme for calculating strain energies. This is just some of the parameters. So there are 66 different atom types that are defined for this purpose. So each atom has, and this is just showing the carbons. There are 14 different kinds of carbons that this scheme requires. Carbon that's in an alkane, that's in an alkene, that's in an alkyne, that's in a cation, that's in a carbonyl group, that's in a carboxylate group, that's in an allene, that's in cyclopentadiene, that's in cyclopropane or cyclopropene, that's in an epoxide or an isonitrile, and so on. All these require different carbon atoms, different sets of numbers that you have to guess. Okay, so their symbol is always going to be that. They have, each of them has a certain van der Waals radius. Most of them are the same for that purpose. Some place they got them from, how much error there is in it, and so on. So anyhow, those are the types of atoms they're going to use, but they're going to be 66 different ones because you're not going to have only carbon. Okay, then you have to say how strong is the spring that you stretch when you stretch the bond. Okay, so it turns out there are 138 different bond stretches, 41 alkane carbon X bonds. So for every bond, there's a certain stretching force constant here, right? And a certain standard bond length, where the energy is zero if they're that far apart. But then if you stretch it, you use Hooke's law with a certain force constant for the spring. Okay, so this is for the bond 1-to-1, that is for an alkane-alkane carbon bond. This is alkane-carbon to alkene-carbon, alkane-carbon to alkyne-carbon, and all these others. Right, so you have to decide what all those numbers should be in order to match experiment. Okay, or then you have to bend bonds too. So there's springs that correspond to bond bending. So here you need a bending force constant, and in fact you need the standard bond angle that you're going to use if you go away from that. And that's the angle if you have two R groups attached to the carbon you're talking about. If you have an R and an H, then it's a different angle. Or if you have whatever two H's, it's still a different angle. So why do you have so many parameters? Because you have to do it in order to make this model match experiment. Okay. Or you have to do bond twistings, and there are 1,494 different bond twistings. So this is the twisting of a carbon-carbon-carbon-carbon bond, about the central bond, right? When all the bonds are alkanes. But if some of them are alkenes or something else, then you have different. And notice that all the way down to here, it's all alkane, alkane, alkyne, and then some other kind of carbon. So there are a load of numbers in these things. Notice that there are three different potential values, V1, V2, V3. Let's see what those are. V3 is what's called a threefold barrier. So that gives that energy, right, with up there at the top with that amplitude. Right, and if you have, there's also a twofold barrier that makes a difference. Let's see here. And there's also a one-fold barrier. So you need these three different parameters, right? And then you add those three together, and that's the torsional contribution to butane, right? The energy at a certain torsional angle. Here's eclipsed, here's anti. Now, is that what it looks like? should ante be a maximum for butane? No, it's a minimum. So this is only part of the energy. There are other parts of the energy, too, that you put in. And the rest of them give you that overall. So in fact, and those come from things like van der Waals repulsion that you put in and so on. So in fact, this particular torsional energy is just tweaking all the other things to make them be a little better. So these are the purpose of showing this, to show you how very intricate a scheme it is and how many arbitrary parameters are put in. So after they've done simplification, the MM3 scheme has more than 2,000 arbitrarily adjusted parameters. Right? Now contrast that with quantum mechanics, where there are no arbitrary parameters at all. The only thing you put in is the masses of the particles, integral charges, and Planck's constant. And everything else you calculate. But it's much harder to calculate than to treat it as if it were springs. Right? But is it a question of garbage in, garbage out? Right? Now, here's a catalog of different schemes that are used for molecular mechanics. Right? That was one particular set of parameters I was showing you. But look at how many... If that worked, if it were true, then it would work for all purposes the same way quantum mechanics does. Right? But that's not the only scheme. Look at these different schemes which I got from Wikipedia. So there are classical force fields. Notice CHARM, a very widely used one, is from Harvard, and that OPLS is from Yale. That's a do you work on that, Connie? Yeah, Connie works in that research group. But here are all sorts of other schemes, each one of which has all these thousands of parameters. Right? Some of them take electrostatics into account and some of them don't. There's one that's only for water because water is so hard to model. Okay? So we've come a long way from the days of Cooper and Crum Brown and Dewar, right? These three Scots who started us up with bonding models and drawings. Okay, now let's just apply molecular mechanics to cyclohexane. Now, if we take ideal bonds, that is the standard angles, the standard distances between atoms, then we have no strain due to stretching or bending, right? But, and no stretch-bend interactions. Now, what's stretch-bend? Well, you have a certain spring for if you're stretching, right? But maybe if the bond is also bent, it's easier to stretch. Or harder to stretch. So you have to put another parameter in to say how you're going to change it when it's doing both things. Okay? So anyhow, you design, but there's torsional energy, 2.2 kilocalories per mole. For example, there's a gauche butane, right? And there's non-1,4 van der Waals interaction. And like, for example, there, because we have a chain of 5 atoms and the interaction between 1 and 5, which is not 1,4. So there are a whole bunch of those in here, and you calculate those up. They give a certain amount of energy. And notice that energy is favorable. It's negative. They're attracting one another, right? And then there's 1,4 van der Waals interaction like that one, which is highly unfavorable. They're running into one another. Okay, so the total is about 8 kilocalories per mole of strain, due mostly, as you see, to these 1,4 van der Waals interactions. Now, what are you going to do about it? Can you see any way to reduce the strain? Well, you move those things that are running into one another apart. But when you do that, what else is going to happen? You're now going to bend and stretch the angle, so you're not going to have zero for the first entries anymore. But anyhow, if with a computer you do all that and minimize the energy, these are the so there's the ideal, and here's what you get after you minimize it. Right? So now you have a little energy from stretching and bending. That's unfavorable. But notice that you've done a much better job here with the things that are repelling one another. Right? They've come down. So the total energy comes down. And here, look carefully at the thing and you'll see how much it changed. It stretches and flattens slightly to reduce the van der Waals repulsion. You see how it opened up a little bit? So that's the real structure of cyclohexane. It's not what we're drawing with things strictly parallel to the axes. They widen out a little bit to lower the energy. Okay? Now notice that there's a gauche butane. right? And we know the energy of, there's six of those as you go around the ring, right? And 6 times 0.9, which was the energy of the strain in gauche-butane, 6 times 0.9 would be 5.4, which is very close to this. So it looks like most of the, it's something like 6 gauche-butanes, right? That's really just a mnemonic device, right? There's nothing fundamental, but at least it makes it easy to remember. Okay, let's see what we have for time. Oh, I got to quit here. Okay, we'll go on with this next time.
Lecture, and you said the boat form turns out to be a maximum of energy and not a real isomer.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so here's the boat. I actually showed a slide about that, but I didn't. This is the boat.
Right.
But it's bad because it's fully eclipsed here.
Okay.
Right, and these things are running together. Now watch what happens. If I twist just slightly, uh-huh, those are no longer eclipsed.
Uh-huh.
And watch these things move apart.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yep.
So that's lower energy.
Yep.
So in fact, to go from here to here, remember this is that thing that's real easy?
Yep.
Right? To go from here to here, from here to here, you have to go over a maximum, which is there. So the true boat is a maximum of energy.
Okay.
And that's what was shown on one of those slides.
Okay.
It was a 1 kilocalorie barrier to go from here to here.
Okay.
So the real form is called a twist boat. That's the energy minimum. And you go from one twist boat to another. And here's what's neat. Watch this. Watch the boat. So if I keep going that way,
uh-huh,
until I get there, do you notice what I have?
But then you have an eclipse. Oh, wait. Oh, it's an inverted boat.
Right. And if I keep going,
and that's another
boat. That's right side up. And if I keep going,
and that's a boat again.
Yeah. So you go from boats that are one way to another, all smoothly, right, in this
right
model.
Right.
But the real thing costs a kilocalorie to go up over, click over this barrier to go from one to the next.
Okay. And why is it not a real isomer then?
Well, because an isomer is an energy minimum.
Oh.
It's an energy maximum between two isomers.
Okay.
Got it?
Okay. When did we say that an isomer is an energy minimum?
I did say that. When we were talking about Paternò, for example, you know, if you could have every phase of rotation, you know, a hundredth of a degree apart was an isomer, that would be nonsense.
Okay.
So the thing to call an isomer is things that are in a valley.
Okay.
All the things in a particular valley are the same isomer.
Okay.
And we can name it by whatever's at the bottom of the valley. And then it'll click over and become another isomer. So here as we rotate from one staggered, up, 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 click, now we're another isomer from here to here. Click, now we're at another isomer. Click, now we're back to the original isomer.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Yep. How are you doing?
If I could see how this works, the chair and the boat.
Yeah.
This one, because I was...
Okay, here's the boat. Right, hold the bow in the stern. Now twist your wrist to bend this down without moving these two.
These ones, right?
Yeah.
So
there, that's a boat, that's a chair.
And so
that's a chair now.
This is a chair, and so this is coming here.
Yeah, there'll be if you do it on this. All right. Now notice all the silver ones are equatorial.
Uh-huh.
And now if I do this, that's a boat, and if I then do that, now the silver ones are all axial.
And this way.
They'll all do what these two do. That's why I made that particular one.
Uh-huh.
Plus, I had a lot of broken ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And I see that we got one more broken one than we had before. So you see why I use the broken ones for this purpose?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Then.